anything related to a toxicity or to a deficiency of a nutrient or something else is a time-dose relationship. High levels for a short period of time could give you an acute reaction. Low levels for a long would take a longer period of time before you begin to see something in the pig or any species. The aflatoxins and all of these toxins, I said species were different, but also the affected organs are different. Some affect the brain, some affect the lung, some affect the liver, some affect the kidney. So all these things and what you look for differs by toxin.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Healthy Farms by Bioverse, your manure management experts. SUNY, we provide value-added. MetaFarms, transforming agriculture with data-driven solutions for pork producers. Hi-D from DSM Firmenich can improve your pig's vitamin D status. Hi-D offers pure, proven performance to help your pigs thrive.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Swine It podcast. I'm your host, Trey Kellner, and today we're going to talk about mycotoxins, which is really timely as we end the harvest season this fall across the Corn Belt. And today we have a leading expert joined today by Dr. Merle Lindelman. Merlin, would you like to introduce yourself to your audience?
Sure. Thank you, Trey. Yeah, I grew up on a mixed livestock and crop farm in southwest Minnesota, bounced around a little bit in college, eventually graduated from the University of Minnesota with a bachelor's degree. And while doing my undergrad program, a senior professor took some interest in a young man and made some suggestions to me, and I went to grad school. Didn't have anything else lined up, and so kept going. Finally, they had to kick me out. I got my PhD. And after that, I went to Virginia Tech and was there for 13 years. And then in 1994, came to the University of Kentucky and have been there for about 30 years. And it's actually, since we're talking about mycotoxins, while at Virginia Tech, a major problem they had in southeast Virginia is aflatoxins. So that's a problem in different parts of the country. So I did quite a few studies there with that particular mycotoxin. And then once moving to Kentucky, because of the different climate and the different soil types and things like that, we have issues with a different type of toxin. And so most of the work that I've done at Kentucky has been with fusarium type toxins. And that would be the names people would recognize would be fumonisin, zearalenone, and deoxynivalenol, or commonly called vomitoxin. So depending where you're at, you have issues with different things. And that's been my experience professionally. And I guess that's why we're here.
Yeah. Yeah. As I said, it's really timely here. I know we're collecting a lot of new crop samples and sending them to our labs to get a little picture of what's out there currently. So let's start big picture and then let's get a little bit more focused. What are mycotoxins? That's a word that a lot of pork producers know about or slat level people know about. But what are they and how do they form on our cereal grains?
Yeah, mycotoxins are what would be called secondary metabolites of the fungi or the molds that are out there in your fields normally. So you've got your fungi that are going through their life cycle, reproducing and growing and everything else. And as they do that, they feed on different things and produce these mycotoxins just as a part of their life cycle. They will form as an energy source. They use starch. And obviously, corn has a lot of starch in it. So they can develop in the field, and which would be what you'd analyze, corn coming out of the field. We're done with our harvest here at Kentucky, and a part of my role in managing the feed mill is analyzing the corn that comes from different farms so that I know what corn I want to keep for our university herds and what I will sell and what I will deal with in other different ways. So they grow in the field, but they can also grow in storage. So especially if you have broken kernels where now your starch is readily available, and if you have the mold still there, and then if you have moisture, so if your bins sweat at night. You go through this hot cold cycle and you get some sweating in the bins, and basically you're dropping a little rain on the top of your bins each day. They'll grow in storage too. So sometimes you, depending on the molds and depending on your storage conditions, you can actually increase your mycotoxins from new crop corn to old crop that's been stored for a long period of time. So they're just the normal metabolites or metabolic products of these molds. And I would say over my career, and now this is kind of different from what you see. When I first started at Virginia Tech and you analyzed your corn for mycotoxins, there are maybe six different toxins they'd look at. Now, if you send away for a screen, you can get a dozen or more of them. So we're looking for more things, and also the analytical capabilities have improved. So a lot of things that when I started might have been measured in parts per million, now we measure in parts per billion because we've got better lab capabilities. So when some of these, I've been doing this every year for a long time, and you maybe measure these six and you'd say, oh, this corn this year, we've only got a problem with two of these, and it's just 1.2 or 1.3 parts per million and no big deal this year. Then the lab gets better equipment and you get your report next year and it's 1,300. Oh, my goodness, everything's going to be dead by the end of the week. And you say, oh, no, okay, it's parts per billion. That's 1,000 times more than the parts per million. So you got to know what you're looking at. So, and instead of just two out of the six, now because we're measuring lower levels, now five out of the six are above detection limits. So it's not that the corn's getting a lot worse. It's just we've got better analytical capabilities. These molds and fungi have always been there. They've always been growing in the field. There's always been something there. And when I was growing up, you'd just have years that the corn this year just, it didn't look as good coming out of the field. And the cattle, the pigs, whatever, just didn't do as well. Well, you always had those years. But now we know what we're looking at. We have capabilities to identify which toxins and better idea of what levels. So it hasn't really changed, so it's not a Chicken Little, the sky is falling type deal. We've always had it. We just didn't know how badly we had it at times, or we didn't know which particular problems we had. Maybe, you know, the six that we analyzed when I started, maybe it's some of these others that are more problematic. We weren't even analyzing for them. So, we could analyze before and say there shouldn't be a problem here. Well, it's something that we don't know about yet. But so we know more, and because of that, because we know what we're looking for, we've got different companies, different researchers that have looked at ways to possibly mitigate some of the adverse effects of these toxins.
When it comes to purity, performance, and immunity, Hi-D has been helping pigs and producers stand strong for years. As the proven source of pure 25-OHD3 for diet fortification, Hi-D is the fastest and most efficient way to provide pigs with essential vitamin D. One product, 7 years on the market, hundreds of research trials, and millions of pigs fed. There's only one Hi-D. Learn more at dsm.com/HY-D.
Yeah, thanks for that introduction. So let's talk about maybe a thing that has changed, here at least over the past 10 to 15 years, and it's maybe higher inclusion of byproducts, especially like distillers or wheat meds, et cetera. So it may sound really simple to some swine nutritionists on why mycotoxins would be higher within those ingredients versus than corn, but maybe just explain that process to those that aren't familiar. So why would mycotoxin concentrations be higher in distillers potentially than, say, just ground corn?
Yeah, sure. Did I just give my Minnesota heritage away there?
Just a little.
So, yeah, when you make fuel ethanol, what are you making this alcohol out of? It's out of the starch. It's a carbohydrate thing. So if you take this kernel of corn and you just suck the starch out to make alcohol, everything else is concentrated depending on how much starch you pulled out of that. And so when you go from corn grain to DDGS, your protein will be higher, your minerals will be higher, your fiber's higher, and your toxins are higher. they're all just concentrated depending on how much carbohydrate was pulled out to go into the alcohol. So it's very natural. And about, this is probably 10 years ago or so, I stopped at a Poet plant in Sioux Falls, where I knew one of the guys who worked there. And we just talked about their screening process. You know, how do you check for toxins? And you still got, you're in an ethanol business, but you got to move this byproduct, this DDGS. I was really impressed with their process of checking. If once the toxins exceeded a certain level, they checked more often. And at some point, they might not even allow those particular batches of DDGS to go to certain species of animals. Because not only do you have the different toxins, but you've got different species that are affected by different toxins. So aflatoxins are not going to affect all the animals on the farm the same, nor are some of the other toxins. So I was really impressed with how those companies were monitoring and considering the customers that they marketed to. So it's a natural thing, and we know it's going to be there. And so any type of use of byproducts, you just got to be talking to your nutritional advisor, whoever that may be, about the products and whether it's an issue this year or next or last year, and what possible options are out there for dealing with that.
Yeah. Thank you for that. So next question is, let's dive into a little bit of your research. So we kind of talked about the ingredient side, right? So how mycotoxins form, what ingredients kind of look at, why they may be in higher concentrations, you know, in dried distillers, grains, et cetera. So once the pig consumes mycotoxins, and of course, this is a little bit different on which mycotoxin we're talking about, right? What's the biology and the impact on the pig? You know, how does the pig absorb these? How do they metabolize them, if at all? How does that work? And then, you know, how do those mitigants then work within the pig and within our feed stuff? So I'll start first, Merlin, with what happens, you know, when the pig consumes feed that may be in higher concentration of mycotoxins.
Yeah, I'm glad you said higher concentrations, because anything related to a toxicity or to a deficiency of a nutrient or something else is a time-dose relationship. High levels for a short period of time could give you an acute reaction. Low levels for a long would take a longer period of time before you begin to see something in the pig or any species. The aflatoxins and all of these toxins, I said species were different, but also the affected organs are different. Some affect the brain, some affect the lung, some affect the liver, some affect the kidney. So all these things and what you look for differs by toxin. So the aflatoxins, fortunately, and from all my work, that's a liver, hepatotoxin, extremely potent carcinogen. I don't get real scared about aflatoxins. They can be managed quite well with different types of clays, a bunch of products on the market. I think they're easy to manage. You get something like zearalenone, which is an estrogenic type mycotoxin. When those are absorbed, what you get is a hyperestrogenism, so you get a swollen vulva on the pigs. If you're feeding the sows, you might have newborn pigs, the gilts having a swollen vulva. You say, this is weird. Look at that big red vulva on this newborn pig. Enlarged red nipples, something like that. So that's an estrogen, hyperestrogen. Deoxynivalenol, another fusarium toxin, is commonly called vomitoxin. So you know why it would commonly be called that, because it affects the brain and you end up vomiting, the pig vomits. But again, it's a dose time relationship. You don't see it, boom, right after the first meal. And you don't see them in all the pigs. That was the thing. Well, with all the work I've done, you can have three pigs in a pen and you'd swear that one of those pigs is jumping over the pen partition at night, going eating out of the other feeder and then coming back. So, and then you got another pig in the pen that you think, man, that pig, we may have to stop the study. That one looks like it's going to die in a couple days. So it's extreme variation. Then the other one that I work primarily with, another fusarium, is fumonisin, and that we're talking more and more about these days. Again, species difference. It affects a horse in the brain. You get brain lesions, so you get crazy horse disease. In a pig, it's more pulmonary, a lung problem there. The fumonisins, they're involved with a particular class of lipids called sphingolipids that affect cell-to-cell communication as well as the cell membrane. And so if you have too many fumonisins, you may get a particular problem with in the lung with less protection on the cells. And so, you know, eventually you get eventually some lung problems. And if you get lung problems, then you become more susceptible to some of the other things that would normally affect the lungs. So a variety of organs affected. And some of these toxins are absorbed and then come back out in the bile and are excreted in the feces. So what's tough there is you don't know whether it was never absorbed and came straight through in the feces or whether it was absorbed, had a negative effect, and then excreted from the bile into the intestine and then into the feces again. Others are excreted in the urine. So it's all over the board. And it just takes some communication between nutritionists and the veterinarian and other things that you see. But some of these things you can see visually, the zearalenone with the hyperestrogenism, the vomitoxin, you can see. If you see observing those things, you definitely need to talk to your advisors about it. And, you know, that's actually a pretty good deal because you know something's going on. The problem from a stand on the farm is those that don't have a clear marker, a biological marker, a biomarker like that, where you're losing 5, 6, 7% on feed intake and growth, and you're not realizing it. But all of a sudden, you got a lighter exit weights. When I was growing up, if the pigs were a little bit light, you just feed them another week. But if you're in a system where you've got to move these pigs out because somebody's coming behind and needs that pen, you've got lower market weights. And then, you know, your normal distribution on weight anyway, you get hit for lightweight pigs. Now you got more in that lightweight category you're getting hit for. So that's tough when you're losing 2, 5, 7% on your feed intake and growth rate and you can't see it. So, yeah, that's where you need to be monitoring what you're feeding.
Yes, for sure. So, yeah, it's definitely good to work with, you know, your nutritional advisor to have, you know, what your mycotoxin picture looks like. And then also, at the very least, just have some markers of where you should be at in your feed budget and what diet should be delivered to you on which day, right? And if you're behind that, then reach out to your veterinarian, your nutritionist, et cetera, to say, hey, you know, based off this budget, I was supposed to get this, you know, 6 days ago or 7 days ago. Like, these pigs are behind, even though mortality's not that bad, right? So, yep. So that's a really, really good point and a good suggestion. So we kind of talked about individual mycotoxins. In some unfortunate circumstances, we're not dealing with one, but as you kind of hinted at, we're dealing with 2, 3, 4, 5. So maybe talk about in your work about, you know, mycotoxin interaction where we're dealing with VOM, zearalenone at the same time and you know, how that can further kind of catalyze the unfortunate situation.
Yeah, it's catalyze is right. I mean, you can look at old surveys, 30, 40 years old, and they may tell you, well, only 30% of the corn is affected and what like that. But as I say, our analytical capabilities are more improved. So now when you analyze and look at surveys in the last 5 to 7 years, you're going to have 80 to 90% of the corn that has some degree of contamination. And if you look at multiple contamination, multiple mycotoxins, it would say that 50, well, depending whether you're talking 2 or 3 or 8 mycotoxins, you're probably in the 70 to 80% that have 2 to 7 mycotoxins. So this co-occurrence is a big issue. You know, it'd be nice to give you answers that are clean cut. Now we got another issue. Work with poultry clearly shows that you can have a variety of interactions here. So that, let's just take for example that, and I'm going to use, say we have a big problem and we're going to reduce growth rate 10%. Well, if you got, well, let's say one toxin reduces growth rate 10%. Let's say the second does 20%, just for the sake. In some work with poultry, that 10 and 20%, you put them together and you get a 30% reduction in growth rate. You say, oh, okay, that makes sense. But some, you get a synergism, and that 10 and 20 becomes a 50 or 60% reduction in growth. It's like, good grief. And interestingly, some other toxins, 10 plus 20 equals 12. You know, so you got an antagonism. So it depends which toxins, which species, and it's a pull your hair out type thing. And you can see that's been happening. You know, it depends on what organs. We talked about some affect the liver, some affect the kidney. So it affects what organs the different toxins are affecting. And that's where you don't know if you got 3-4 toxins, which one is giving you how much effect. You maybe know how much growth rate you're losing or something like that, but which one was the problem? Did I have a degree of synergism between these two and this other was antagonistic, or now we've got an added synergism? And so that's where initially when I was working with aflatoxins, it was pretty much that is what I was working with. Now that I'm working with the fusariums, we don't have a lot of absolute biomarkers on some except for the fumonisins. And I mentioned they were involved with a particular class of lipids called sphingolipids. There has been work, and there is a product on the market now, and we worked with it some, where there is a very clear biomarker. And I give the name and it doesn't matter. The two things that are affected in the body are sphingosine and sphingonine. And there's a ratio between the two, and you can check that. It's expensive to do, but it's, you know, we can do it. We were able to restore those sphingonine, sphingosine levels 95 to 98% with that particular product on the market. It's called, it's an enzyme that actually breaks the particular mycotoxin, the fumonisin. With the aflatoxins, those we bound them to a clay and just carried them on out through the gut. With this one, it's an enzyme that breaks that particular mycotoxin, and we know it works. I actually helped back in 2013 with some studies with a company that was developing that, and then have recently tested that, and it's nice. It's been approved by the FDA and actually up in Canada also with their regulatory agencies. And so for some mycotoxins, we have a biomarker that we would love to have. And researchers are continuing to look for biomarkers for the other mycotoxins. So, you know, in years, we'll have more information. We'll know even more. But right now, we've got a good biomarker for the fumonisins.
Yeah, and Merlin, I thought you did a really good job of this in the introduction, but maybe just to reemphasize it here later in the podcast that mycotoxins are important, but it's important also to not be an alarmist on it either, right? Just explain once again, like we have analytical tools, we've talked about, you know, clays and enzymes, et cetera. You know, maybe for the common, you know, pork producer that's out there saying, I see all this marketing material or all this news on, you know, mycotoxin levels in this crop year. What strategies would you have them and or have them follow and, you know, maybe talk about this is important, but we also have solutions too, right?
Yeah, some of them are really quite easy. You know, we've always had the problem. We're just aware more of what this bad year corn really is. So we've always had the problem. when I was in Virginia, had a consulting veterinarian that I talked to quite a bit. He had a couple million finishing pigs on where he was just adding a clay to the diet as a safety thing. And he said the thing he consistently heard from his producers was they had more even marketing weights, didn't have as, it was just a tighter group. So just like I said, that everything is a time dose relationship. There's individual pig variation. Some pigs aren't affected at all, but those pigs that are affected the most, those are the ones that you can benefit the most. So we, so for the aflatoxins, we have that. I mentioned the fumonis, the Fumzyme product for fumonisins, but I'll go and bring you up something much simpler, and that's screening the corn. I mentioned that it comes, that a lot of these things, especially the stuff that grows in storage, is going to be on the fines. So with our work at Kentucky, you know, I have companies come and say, well, we want to do some work. And I say, I don't have real bad corn this year. But we screened out, we just run it over a screener, and we had a batch of corn, a bin of corn, 10,000 bushels. We screened and we saved about 250 bushel out of there. So we screened out about 2.5% of the bin as fines. And it took what was our general level of toxin for that bin. We screened out about 80 to 85% of the fumonisin. We screened out probably only about 60% of the zearalenone, and I can't remember what it was on the DON, on the deoxynivalenol vomitoxin. I don't remember. But so just something like screening to get rid of those smaller particles makes a big improvement on things. So that's something in a worst case situation that one could do. So you can got the physical thing of screening. Then if you know which toxins are, you can go with some things, different products that might be a type of clay, you know, and there are enhanced clays that companies have worked with. You can also go with the Fumzyme for the fumonisins. Just quite a variety of things that you have as options. And it's just a matter of communication with those who are either supplying products to you or your technical advisors, be it a veterinarian or nutritionist or both.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's an ingredient source decision, right? So it's which distillers am I using, which mids am I using, and or at what levels, right? So sometimes, hey, our corn's pretty clean, but our distiller's source, you know, 30 miles away is pretty high in VOM or zearalenone or whatever it may be. Hey, let's use a lower amount, or maybe let's try to find a different source or not include it this crop year, right? So,
yeah, absolutely. And I would say that, you know, in our work where we screened out the fines, we, you know, then you got a question, what do we do with the fines? Variety of things one can do, you know, finishing cattle aren't as susceptible to quite as many of these. And they're an older animal compared to a younger animal, nursery pig and a pregnant sow. I stay away from as much as possible with anything. But I would say this, when we screened out the fines, we had a hopped up level of fines. So we cleaned up the corn, but the fines are bad stuff. But bad stuff for a producer is a nice stuff for a researcher. So we're going to do some studies. So we did nursery pig studies with those, and you know, we had fumonisin, zearalenone, and deoxynivalenol. We had those three. We fed 20% fines in the diet, which got us up to FDA cautionary levels on a couple of these. We couldn't slow the pigs down in a three-week study, you know, and so this is a problem too, is you don't always see it. It's a time dose thing. So we had to come back to a second study, said, you boys aren't going to slow down. We're going a higher level. We're going a longer period of time. So we go at 20, 40, and 60% fines in the diet. 40% did nothing to them. It wasn't until we got to 60% fines, which was total replacement of the corn in those nursery diets, that we slowed them down. And we didn't, it still didn't really knock them in the head very much, we still only slowed down about 12-13%. Yeah, I mean, it's a bad from a production standpoint if you were that. But I got to separate my good and bad pigs if I'm going to look at a product and its ability to recover some. I've got to get them separated. If I show this much of a difference, I don't know if my product's working. You get bounce in your data. So I've got to separate them. So it took 60% fines for 6 weeks before I started separating them. So it's tricky. So you got to know what you're feeding. And if you talk to your advisors and go to some type of mitigation or control program, you can, I'll never say you can eliminate everything, but you can do a good job of dealing with the issue. So I think there's reason to not be totally dejected. We've always had the problem. Now we just know what it is. Now we have some solutions. If we communicate, if we do some lab analysis, we can get a plan for moving forward.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that pork producers can't control. This might be one of them, kind of, right? So, yeah.
It's time for our famous three. We have a time and labor-saving product for you. AgriSlats by Healthy Farms is your solution. No more lugging jugs around the barn every month. With AgriSlats, you simply drop the slat through the floor twice a year, and it works to break down solids, reduces crusting and forming. To learn more, visit myhealthyfarms.com. I want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Anatox. Research shows that feed sanitizers reduce the onset of viruses in commercial swine feed. Improve swine productivity through powerful pathogen control with Anatox today. Trow Nutrition North America. Everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science. Vaccinova. Formulate to your needs. Custom-made vaccines. Visit us at vaxinova.us.com for more info. That's vaxinova.us.com. AccuFast. The best way to predict the future is to create it. Start creating your future today at AccuFastSwine.com. AB Vista. New nutritional perspectives and novel enzyme applications to drive pig production.
Awesome. Well, hey, I have four fun questions in this podcast on so our listeners can get to know you a little bit better. The first one, Merlin, is what's the biggest hurdle you overcame in your career that you're the most proud of?
Oh, whew. I wish I'd heard that one before I thought about it. I don't know. I think it kind of goes to what we're talking about here is at times I've worked alone. At other times I've worked as part of a team. You know, you just have change in personnel and stuff. Whenever you're working alone and think about things, your ideas sound pretty good. You know, I've found that I've contributed the most when we've had some interaction and dialogue and somebody has challenged me on some of my things. Preconceptions and biases can get you locked in somewhere and you might not be right. And so I think just learning to communicate, learning to not have to be right all the time, being comfortable, somebody challenging me has been a good thing. And I think that's what I say here too. You know, if you think you got a problem, talk to somebody about these things that we've talked about. Don't say, well, let's wait a month and see if it clears up. You might be further in the hole. Yeah. And so, you know, just communicate. There's not a lot of right things that are absolutely right, absolutely wrong. A lot of things, the answer is it depends. So find out what your situation is, and then it depends on that, on where you want to go and what you want to do with it. So I'd say learning to be a good team member has been very valuable.
And that's awesome. So to build off of that, what's your best piece of advice that you give a young professional or graduate student that comes into your office on, hey, what's kind of one thing that you would tell me that you wish you would have heard when you were in my shoes?
Well, even so, along with this list, being willing to be challenged and The other thing is when you go out and you look for advice, see, you go away to college and you think, oh, professor said this. Well, not every professor at every university is saying that. You've got this perspective, you've got that perspective. So don't think that the first thing you hear is, here's the answer. Get another perspective. There's a range, and everybody doesn't have to be over here or over here. Listen to both sides. Realize that there might be more than one perspective, and then you decide. Even nutrition, we don't all recommend the same thing. Some of us are very aggressive in our recommendations of what you ought to do. Some are extremely conservative in what they would say. And the person who's conservative has a reason for being conservative. The person who's aggressive has a reason for. So again, talk through that. Say, well, you said this, but another nutritionist said that. You know, what do I do? Is it, why did you say this? Why did you say that? So just realize there's a range of opinion.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for sharing. What's your favorite part about the fall?
Favorite part about the fall?
Yeah.
Now, I presume you mean the fall season and not
fall
the fall
season.
Man.
Yes. The fall season. Yeah.
I mean, the fall man, that was a bad deal. The fall season. Oh, I just, you know what I really loved? When I was at Minnesota, up in the Twin Cities, and then drive down to Worthington, where I graduated from high school. In the fall, I just loved running down Highway 169, and you see combines in the field, and you see that grain coming out of the bin. I just love the crop coming in out of the field. I just love to see that. Of course, you know, you've got more color and all that, but I just love seeing the crop come in.
Oh, yeah. No, it was really cool around this neck of the woods this year with how, you know, fast harvest was, you know, no weather breaks at all. I mean, it was 24/7 around here. So, no, that's awesome. So last question, and then we'll let you off the hook here. What's your favorite pork recipe? And do you have a good one to share with our audience?
Pork recipe. Well, I don't know what you call it, but I love pork tenderloin. And there's a Caribbean recipe that my wife has where it's in a crust and over rice, and then there's a mango sauce on the top of that. I really, really like that one.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Thanks for reminding me of that. I may may go downstairs and mention something.
Exactly. Yeah, you'll have to put it on this week's menu for sure. So, well, thank you so much for your time and sharing your expertise, Dr. Linneman. We really appreciate it. Wish you the best here as you enter the holiday season and close out the year. And thanks to our listeners. We come out with new episodes every Tuesday and hope you check them out on a weekly basis.
Thanks a lot.